I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:16 on Monday, May 2nd. Members present are Representatives Snyder, Nelson, Sponholz, Fields, and McCarty. Items on the agenda today include House Bill 301 on a renewable portfolio standard, HB 382 insulin coverage, SB 190, RCA and refuse utilities, and moving confirmations. Representative Shragi is here as well. Let's start with utilities and the renewable portfolio standard. The order of invited testimony is going to be Chris Rose, Julie Esty, and Brian Hickey, Alan Mitchell, and Aaron McKittrick. So, Mr. Rose, please go ahead with your invited testimony. Thanks for being here. And you're still muted.
Thank you. Can you hear me out?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Chris Rose. I'm the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today. REAP is a statewide nonprofit organization that's been working to promote renewable energy and energy efficiency since 2004. And if you could move to the next slide, please. We have multiple education programs around the state. We work both in rural and urban Alaska, promoting not only STEM education in the schools to make sure that children understand where the energy comes from, but a lot of workforce development as well to make sure that we have people here in the state to operate and maintain and optimize renewable energy and energy efficiency projects into the future. Next, please. Been involved in advocacy before this body since 2008, when we helped pass the Renewable Energy Fund that most of you know about. It's appropriated, the legislature's appropriated more than $275 million since 2008 for renewable energy projects around the state through that program. And more recently, we're supportive of Senate Bill 123, which passed the legislature 2 years ago to create the first electric reliability organizations in the state, which will affect the rail belt. Next, please. Why do we need more renewable energy in the rail belt? I would start out by saying that the rail belt as a whole is dangerously dependent on one high-priced fuel. That's cooking natural gas. So from just a perspective of looking at a portfolio of where we get our energy from, we're really dependent just on one source. We also have very high electricity rates in the state, in the rail belt, because of that. We're paying about twice as much for cooking the gas as lower 48 utilities are paying for their gas. We also have all the renewable energy resources here in the rail belt. We have wind, solar, hydro, geothermal, biomass, and tidal. And finally, we have a history of inaction in the rail belt. It took roughly 40 years for Senate Bill 123 to pass to create a mechanism for the rail belt utilities to work together. We have no energy policy that really focuses on making sure that consumers in the rail belt are protected. And so Senate Bill 123 really did a lot by creating a mechanism to make sure that in the future we will do regional planning. And this bill, if it were to pass, would be executed through that regional planning process. Next, please. This is a graph that I'm not going to get too far into, but I wanted to make sure it was in your packet to just show you over the last 11, 12 years, how quickly solar and wind prices have come down. The gold line represents the average cost of solar over that time. The bluish line is the average cost of wind over that time. And the dotted line is the average cost of natural gas in the lower 48. So we now see wind and solar competitive with natural gas in lower 48. And remember, we are paying about twice as much for natural gas in Cook Inlet. So there is a strong argument to be made that wind and solar are competitive in the rail belt right now. All those little circles represent individual contracts between utilities and independent power producers. And the bigger the contract, the bigger the circle, the bigger the contract. But that's a rough showing of where we have seen prices go. Solar's come down around 90% in the last 10 years. Wind has come down about 70% in the last 10 years in price. Next, please. This slide here is a bar graph that really is a great.
Could you just pause for a second? Representative Sponholz had a question.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Mr. Rose. On the last slide, looking at the declining wind and solar prices, know, there is a federal tax credit that's helped to make solar a lot less costly for Americans. And my understanding is that that expires, and I think it's FY24. Do you know what the if there's already a vehicle going, you know, introduced federally to extend that further? What the future of that that renewable energy tax credit is?
Through the chair, Representative Spanholtz, that's a great question. There have been discussions in Congress to continue to extend the production tax credit, but as of now, I know that I don't know of any package that it's in.
All right, thank you.
Sure. But this next slide actually goes a little bit to Representative Spanholtz's question, because this is an analysis that's done every year by a consulting group called Lazard that actually compares the unsubsidized cost of all different energy resources. So the lighter blue are renewable energy resources, the darker blue are conventional resources. And you can see the cost of solar and wind, the light blue bars, solar and wind are roughly $30, $28, $26 a megawatt hour. That is now the cheapest unsubsidized electricity that can be produced. So we have gotten quite far in the last 10 years. If you look down below there, the conventional resources, you will see those gold numbers. Those gold numbers, for instance, for nuclear at $29 is a fully depreciated plant. If you were to build new nuclear today, you'd go over to the right where you'd see those dark blue bars, and it would be more like $130 to $204 a megawatt hour. Likewise with combined cycle natural gas, you see that a fully depreciated plant today might be selling power for as low as $24 a megawatt hour, but new combined cycle natural gas plants are in a range of $45 to $74 a megawatt hour. And Cook Inlet is produced, the variable region is producing gas much higher, much closer to that $74 price. Next, please. This is a graph that just gives folks an idea of one resource and how it is being utilized in several states. This is just wind power. In Texas, they are now receiving 20% of all their electricity from wind. In my home state of Iowa, now 58% of all the electricity produced in the state is wind power. And you can see there are many other states in the Midwest, Oklahoma, Kansas, North Dakota, South Dakota, Colorado, Nebraska, all getting huge percentages, increasing percentages of their electricity from wind. Next, please. The next slide shows an important part of this picture, which is the cost of energy storage, at least in the cost of lithium-ion batteries. We're also seeing a sharp decline in the cost of lithium-ion batteries, and a large driver for that, of course, is electric vehicles. But there are other consumer products that are using lithium-ion batteries that are creating greater economy scale and then driving the price down. So we expect to see the price of energy storage continuing to go down, which can help integrate variable renewables like wind and solar. Next, please. This is just a quick graph showing what the current energy mix in the United States is right now, about 20% renewable. And there's a little cutout on the left to show you what the actual percentages of all the different renewables are. But it's definitely an increasing percentage as the price of these resources goes down. Next, please. This is a great map of where we already have either renewable energy portfolio standards or clean energy standards. There are 30 states that have renewable portfolio standards, which is what this bill started out as. And there are five states that have clean energy standards. So the majority of the states in the country have standards like this that drive the portfolio toward more clean energy. Next, please. Just to reiterate here, we are very dependent. Our portfolio is heavily dependent on just one resource. That resource is provided by a virtual monopoly, that's Hilcorp. We also don't have a lot of factors that are going to see our prices drop. We've got flat demand, high production costs in Cook Inlet, aging infrastructure. We also have had a lot of what are now fairly unsustainable state gas subsidies for Cook Inlet. Next, please. This is a graph of the price of Cook Inlet natural gas from 1994 up through 2022. And you can see that we are just around the $8 range for a cooker like gas. We're around $4 in the lower 48 for Henry Hub, and that has gone up significantly in the last year or so. So we have very, very high prices for our natural gas, despite the fact that it's produced in the state, because we have a very small market. Next, please. I just want to quickly go over this to make sure the committee members are aware that the governor did ask the National Renewable Energy Laboratory to look into whether or not 80% by 2040 renewables was a possibility, and the NREL was able to come up with a study in fairly short time that found two things. Number one, that there are actually multiple pathways. They only looked at six, but there are multiple pathways for the rail belt to achieve 80%, importantly, without impacting the reliability of the grid. So that is an excellent finding that we now have from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. The second finding is, if we get the 80% renewable, we'll be saving $400 to $500 million a year in natural gas fuel prices. So that's a significant amount of money that we would be saving for consumers. And the question then is, well, how much would it cost to get there? So the next slide is a preliminary analysis. I think you'll hear more later on from Alan Mitchell, who did this analysis. But because NREL had not had the time to look through and do the capital cost analysis of for instance, the scenario three, wind and solar and some hydro, how much that would cost, Alan Mitchell from Analysis North did this preliminary analysis using very conservative assumptions, and found that actually the capital cost of getting to 80% wind and solar and a little bit of hydro would be $3.2 billion compared to $6.7 billion of fuel cost savings. So a very excellent 2-to-1 ratio of savings. Next, please. I want to mention very quickly that the bill that was passed by the legislature 2 years ago, Senate Bill 123, actually now has created a mechanism to execute a policy like this. I am actually part of a group that has been meeting for the last 2 years to develop an application to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, which was submitted at the end of March. If the RCA certificates that group, we would become the first electric reliability organization in the state, and we would be required to do integrated resource planning for the entire region, which would do technical and economic feasibility on a range of portfolio options. So if the legislature says get to this goal, then the ERO would actually do the analysis to find the portfolios to get there. I just want to quickly mention a few things that I would respectfully ask the committee to consider amending. First of all, the initial requirement of 25% by 2030. The original bill had a requirement in 2025 and then 30% by 2030. For a couple of reasons, we would suggest moving that requirement back up to 30% and moving a timeline down somewhere in the middle between 2025 and 2030. We think it's important to keep us moving forward rather than allowing us to be complacent and wait till 2030 before we reach these initial goals. And we do believe, since we're around 20% right now, that getting to 30% by the next goal is possible. We would also suggest raising the proposed fine from $20 a megawatt hour up to closer to $50 a megawatt hour, which is actually about the national average for these kinds of fines. And finally, we would suggest reorganizing the clean energy credit scheme, and we will provide some detailed technical comments on that. Next, please. So in conclusion, if we were to pass a bill like this for the rail belt, it would really diversify our portfolio of generation for electricity, which is super important. It would increase the resiliency in the state because, you know, the rail belt is really the heart of the economic engine of the entire state. It would displace a lot of very expensive fuel in the form of coal, kibble, natural gas, and save that gas for what we need it for even more, which is heating. It will utilize a lot of local flat price renewable energy resources and not impact the reliability of the grid. And in fact, it would keep us competitive in a very fast changing world where people are demanding renewable energy. And also impacts our independence, our energy independence, by using local resources that we have. it's also going to support a movement that's already occurring, which is a movement toward electrifying transportation and electrifying heat in the future. We need to make sure that electricity, if we can get it from renewables, comes from local renewable resources. And that's going to create a lot of jobs and keep hundreds of millions of dollars circulating in our economy every year that people can use to purchase other things. Most importantly, I think we need to establish a standard like this to actually trigger action, because folks have heard about the 25% 50% renewable by 2025 that was talked about by the legislature back in 2010, but that was not an enforceable standard. And so we really need a standard like this that requires action and has consequences in the form of fines if utilities aren't able to reach those targets by the dates that are set out in the standard. And we believe all these requirements are achievable. We think they're achievable even faster than the current legislation requires, and we really appreciate the opportunity to make this testimony in front of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Rose. And I'm going to suggest we roll through invited testimony, and then Ryan Johnston can summarize the changes from the Energy Committee. Next up, invited testimony is Julie Esty along with Brian Hickey from MEA and CEA, respectively.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. My name is Julie Esty, and I am the Director of External Affairs and Strategic Initiatives for Matanuska Electric Association. Along with me, as Chair Fields has mentioned, I have Brian Hickey. He's the COO from Chugach Electric. And then also on the phone, we do have Carrie Ann Baker from Homer Electric Association, as well as Daniel Heckman from Golden Valley Electric Association. Today, our comments will be fairly brief and expand on and reemphasize our written comments and public testimony that we've provided to the House Energy Committee on April 5th, and then our testimony before that committee on April 26th. And I think to start with, I'd like to just say we definitely agree with Chris Rose that diversifying the energy portfolio is an important step for the Rail Belt. And the Rail Belt utilities have been very clear in both our actions and testimony, written and oral, that we support effective policy for creating a diversified energy portfolio. When MEA surveys our members, and we have, a very diverse district, but by and large a fairly conservative district, 70 to 80% say, yes, we want some sort of carbon reduction or renewable energy portfolio. So it's something our members are interested in. Then when we ask them the question, okay, what if it will impact your rates or your reliability? That's when the support for it starts to decline pretty significantly. And so what we hear from our members is they're interested in innovation. They're interested in energy diversification, but they want to make sure that our primary responsibility around reliability and rates are kept whole as well. And those members, we represent the same people. Our members are your constituents. And so that's why we're here in front of you now to share with you how we believe we can adjust this bill and make some really smart policy, because the time is really right now to make a transition. And I think there's a lot of opportunity here if we can just come together and make some smart decisions. In fact, I was listening to the testimony in House Energy from Jen Miller. Jen Miller is the CEO of Renewable IPP. They've been a fabulous partner with MEA in bringing on cost-effective solar power, both in Willow and now hopefully in Houston. And she spoke about this transition. And MEA and the rest of the Rail Belt is really at a critical time for transition. And this transition is big. And we shouldn't pretend it's going to be easy. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. But that means that we should do it right, and we should be smart. And that starts here with policy. And so that's why we're here with you all now. We believe that the purpose section added in a recent committee substitute in the House Energy Committee was well written and clearly describes attributes of a successful and sustainable clean energy standard. And we really appreciate the addition of that, because I think it brings us all together around common goals. The utilities before you today and on the phone have worked earnestly to make revisions to the bill that provide cost and reliability protection for our consumers, as well as due consideration for the realities of our current system. Our system is limited and an islanded system. So there's different considerations. And we also have very few number of ratepayers to spread costs over. So that's something also, as we're considering in a transition, needs to be part of the plan. So the goals listed in the purpose section as one, to minimize costs. This is also our priority, as I've spoken to. The rate impact will be to our members. And again, there's a lot of positive reasons to make the transition, but we want to make sure we do it right to limit that impact. It will provide price stability and enhance opportunities for economic growth and maximize grid resiliency, as well as minimizing carbon emissions. So as member-owned co-ops, those are all very important parts, each equal in how we move this forward. We'd like to commend the House Energy Committee and Sherman Schrage on their efforts to listen to all the stakeholders involved and really bring a committee substitute, a current version of this that has significant amount of support. We believe the bill is very close to something that can achieve the goals established in the purpose section. And we do have a few topics that were raised in public testimony that we'd like to address. Brian, I'll hand it over to you.
Sure. Thank you very much. And I want to reiterate what my colleague said. We really appreciate the effort you all have taken, and Chairman Schrage, your efforts to get the whole spectrum of comments and talk to everyone from every side. I think at the end of the day, we'll come to a product that is both achievable and sustainable and can be done in a technically effective way. There are a couple things that I want to address. One is the NREL study, and I wanted to be clear that the NREL study does not say that. The NREL study did not look at reliability. If I would draw your attention to figure 4 on page 10 of the study, they did not do any reliability analysis. What they actually did was ran a production costing model. And a production costing model will tell you if you have enough capacity in every hour a day to meet load. There's a significant amount of work that needs to be done to actually do the reliability analysis. And I think the NREL folks were upfront about that in their assessment. Another issue that we did want to bring up is particularly with respect to section 4205-785A, which is the large project pre-approval process within the language of SB 123, included in that was a statement that an and in the CS, there's an and that says that those projects cannot be concluded if they are detrimental to the LSE achieving its goals under the RPS. That particular section of SB 123 was put in place so that local areas could develop reliability projects to meet local reliability, and constraining that, and typically those have to be dispatchable resources. Generally, wind and solar are non-dispatchable, so they come and go when they come and go. And so that particular section constrains those local regions from actually building necessary reliability projects that are not included in the IRP that comes out of the ERO. So that sort of that particular addition sort of am I using too many? The integrated resource plan that comes out of the electric reliability organization. So that actual section constrains the folks from actually building reliability projects that are necessary and have not been included in an integrated resource plan that comes out of the electric reliability organization. So that's a thought there.
Yeah, and thanks, Brian, for bringing that up. The electric reliability organization was something that was formed. Chris mentioned it in Senate Bill 123 a couple of years ago. And that really brings all the stakeholders around the table to, one, talk about standards, reliability standards. How much redundancy do we want to pay for? And then the second part is integrated resource planning. So all of the stakeholders, we've got utilities, non-utilities, independent power producers, the state of Alaska, consumer advocates, we're all around the table, and we have an independent staff that will help us come up with an integrated resource plan. There's going to be a lot of public process, a lot of transparency, and a lot of fun money to be spent coming up with an integrated resource plan. As Chris mentioned, that is a natural place for these two efforts to merge. And I agree with him, but I agree on a different level. There's going to be a lot of, again, a lot of conversation, a lot of transparency and involvement. And this having an RPS out in front, or sorry, a clean energy standard out in front of that basically gives the that group the answers. And I think that is one way for policy members to impact that. Since you all, through a previous legislator, have already empowered that group of stakeholders to come together as approved by the RCA and come up with an integrated resource plan, one suggestion is to have the current goals perhaps confirmed by that process. So there'd be a feedback loop from that process back into policy to say, hey, are we asking something that's impossible? Are we asking too much here? And so that's something to consider as we're going through this process. The other thing that I'll point out in the NREL study is there was no real economic analysis. And that's not no fault of NREL's. They just didn't have the time or the scope to do that. We would definitely support a second phase of NREL studies to help confirm the numbers, to help look at economics. What they did do was they did an analysis of the potential fuel savings, which is a good start, but it also does not include the cost to achieve those. And as Chris mentioned, Alan Mitchell, REAP commissioned Alan Mitchell to do a preliminary economic analysis. And Alan, we've had a chance to work with Alan at MEA. He's great. You'll hear from him later. He's a very strong analyst and cares very, very deeply about this subject. And so I think that what he did was a great start, but it would be good to have further conversation, a little bit more vetting around that. And NREL does this stuff for other places all the time. And I think the utilities had started doing our own economic analysis and realized no matter what we come up with, it probably won't be credible, right? Because, and I think that's similar to Alan's, right? So I think having NREL do some sort of similar analysis, more in-depth analysis would really benefit the public policy discussion. Brian.
Sure. So, and for those of you who were not on the Energy Committee, some of you will have already heard this before, but, you know, we are going to require significant transmission investment in the rail belt to actually move renewable power from one location to another. Currently, there are two transmission lines that tie the three areas together. The Anchorage of the Kenai line, which is owned by Chugach, moves about 75 megawatts. That is about 10% of the peak load of the railroad, and that's all we can move on that line, and it's a single contingency line. When it's out of service, we have no access to Bradley Lake resources, nor would we have access to Dixon Creek, nor would we be able to carry the energy from Dixon Creek on that line. Going north, Dixon Creek is the project that is being proposed near the Bradley Lake facility on the Kenai on Kachemak Bay, and I'm sorry if I'm... I'm a little too. Thank you, Julie.
Brian's been at the rail boat now for like 30 years, so he knows a lot. He's a great resource.
I don't have a question. It's more of a comment, just that legislators are an inch deep and a mile wide, and we serve on many different committees with lots of different acronyms, and this is your language. And I just want to remind you that we just need to translate a little so we can just make sure we've got like maximum comprehension on the part of the committee. So if you can speak out your acronyms as much as possible, that's super helpful. And maybe next year and we can let you use all of your alphabets, but it's really, it'll help us make sure we're fully understanding what you're talking about.
Thank you.
I say this as a former energy committee member, but I want to make sure I'm clear.
Darn good one.
Thank you so much. We are going to have to invest in the transmission infrastructure. The line from Anchorage to Fairbanks carries about 80 megawatts. Once again, that's about 10% of our peak load that we can actually move on that, and it's a single contingency line. And there are significant that's going to cost a fair amount of money. We are out actively seeking federal infrastructure funding on this, and there's some important legislation in HB 414 and SB 241, which will allow AEA, give them receipt authority for federal funds out of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. It's important that those bills get passed through. But in addition
Mr. Hickey, if I could just jump in, are those provisions of 414 included in the current Senate Finance CS, which rolled in many provisions of 414?
I do not know that.
Okay.
I do not
Thanks.
Know that. They were, but I don't know at the current time. In addition to federal funding and utility contributions, it's likely that there'll have to be state funding for some of the transmission, because actually building out that level of transmission could be done by the utilities, but it would result in significant rate increases. So it's really beyond the financial capabilities of the rail belt at this point in time.
Another thing that we've heard is that $20 a megawatt hour is not a steep enough fine, and we would respectfully disagree with that. We are utility co-ops. You know, we are nonprofit co-ops. We don't have shareholders that we can go grab these fines from. Any fines will be paid for by our members somehow, whether it's through rates or it would come out of their margins, which is their capital credits. And so I assure this committee that any fine, especially one at $20 a megawatt hour, which would need to be paid not only just the fine, but we're paying that on top of what we're also paying for if we didn't do anything, that's what we would be paying that on top of what we're already paying then for the generation, the gas power generation. So we're already paying a lot for the gas power generation, and then we would pay a lot more for this fine. So I assure you that a $20 megawatt hour fine is more than adequate deterrent for a member-owned cooperative. Again, most of the member-owned cooperatives in the lower 48 are actually, a lot of them are exempt from these sorts of requirements, but because of some of our limitations on where money comes from, and so we do not have investor-owned utilities on the rail belt that can absorb these sorts of fines. So just wanted to be clear on that.
And just to follow on that, I think that including it in rates as opposed to taking it out of our margins is critical. And I know there was some discussion at the Energy Committee that there are some items which actually are not allowed in rates, things like advertising or lobbyists. Those are relatively small numbers in the scope of margins. For example, Chugach's margins last year were in 2021 were about $9.7 million. The penalty, Chugach's portion of the 30% penalty, if we were to miss the target, would be $4.5 million. That is half of our margins. That moves us into areas where our debt covenants, which require us to collect, I don't want to use any acronyms here, 110% of our margins for interest over interest, that pushes us into a realm where we actually could go into technical default, which requires and the RCA is required to set rates under 4205, 431 that allow us to recover costs that are contracted for in bond covenants. So there's sort of a dichotomy there, I think. And I think the challenge is that this number is much bigger than anything that is currently disallowed in rates for a cooperative, and our margins are razor thin. We're co-ops. We return that money to our members. So I think that not having it recovered in rates and trying to recover it out of capital credits is a challenge that could push utilities into difficult financial straits. One of the issues that has also been brought up in the Energy Committee and in the NREL study is that we should be able to put large quantities of wind and solar on the system and shut down our gas turbines for extended periods of time. The challenge with that in the rail belt, and it's not something that can't be done, but it's something that needs to be studied and understood very carefully, is that there's minimum deliverability takes out of the inlet to keep the wells actually producing natural gas. The home heating sector is still drawing gas out of there, but as you shut down gas turbines and shut down deliverability, it's likely that we will lose deliverability in the basin, and that will increase both the cost of gas and the availability of it. So while that concept works well sort of at the 100,000 foot level, when we get down into the details, we're really going to have to figure out how do you transition off of Cook Inlet natural gas without losing Cook Inlet natural gas altogether. And so that's one of the critical components that we think is really needs to be addressed in the CES.
Yeah, so the utilities have been pretty consistent in voicing what we feel like are necessary. One of those was rate caps and reliability assurances. There was something in this the most recent version that, as amended by the House Energy Committee, that added some considerations for the RCA to be able to keep an eye on that, and we would anticipate that the RCA would write some more detailed regulations to help spell that out. That is their responsibility, right? It's to look after the rate impacts and reliability of the utilities, and so this would just assure that is happening. There are other places that have their regulatory commissions the ability to say adjust the RPS if they feel like that is going above and beyond what they need. That is not what we're asking for here. What we were asking for is really just the RCA to be able to raise their hand or put limits, put guardrails on. We know that currently most of our renewable energy, you saw Chris's graph where the cost is going down. When you look at a graph from ours, and we did hand one out to House Energy, we're happy to send that to this group. But right now, currently, most of our renewables are above the avoided cost of producing with gas generation. That's just the reality of where we are today. Ideally, that shifts, right, in the future, and that's what we're all banking on. If it doesn't shift, then it's our members who are holding the bag, and it's the RCA's responsibility already to look at rates and reliability, and so putting some guardrails on what's acceptable is important to all of us. And so we appreciate House Energy Committee making some changes on that, and look forward to the RCA creating more. We talked about the ERO, and that's another one of ours. It's to really have that feedback loop from the ERO process back into the clean energy standard. The third is that fines should be recovered in rates. And Brian talked a little bit about that. Right now, the current legislation has those not allowed to be recovered in rates. Again, as a member-owned co-op, we don't have the shareholders that we can pull funding from. We just have rates and then margins, which is what's left over. Those get reinvested back into the co-op and eventually paid out as capital credit. So either way you pull at it, it impacts our members. And so there was some really, really good discussion on that with Commissioner Pickett from the RCA at House Energy, and hopefully that can be further discussion here. And we're happy to provide more information. Brian, do you want to go into that at all?
I intend to write an amendment on that so that the fines would be put back into building renewable generation, so it meets the purpose of the bill and would be clear to consumers. So we'll circulate that when it's available.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Funnels.
So in looking at the chart that was distributed to committee members about cooking natural gas usage, I mean, there's a pretty significant decline that's taken place over the last, 20 years now at this point in time. How many more years do we have to be able to reliably count on Cook Inlet natural gas to provide energy to Rail Belt Alaskans?
Are you asking us to respond? Okay, well, I think that's a great question that I wish I had the magic crystal ball for. My understanding, and it's limited, so I think that's probably a fair question to ask of Hillcorp Natural Gas or the folks that are supplying, but that there is gas out there if the deliverability of that gas. And so it may not be what they call behind pipe. So there's gas out there, but to get it connected into the system and delivered, there's a cost to that. And so there will be decisions made as to whether those costs are economically worth it. And, so that's my understanding of where we are. Brian, do you want to?
I think that's a fair statement. There are no reserves of Cook Inlet gas. They are not, many of them are not behind pipe. And so there is going to be significant investment in Cook Inlet to actually get that behind pipe, or we'll have to go a different way. There's, hydroelectric projects like Watana and Dixon Creek that could bridge that gap. There is solar and wind that can be used to fill in some of the gaps there. So I think that transition is necessary, but there certainly is a requirement to invest in Cook Inlet if we're going to maintain the gas fields out there.
But it's a great question because it's one that we're all talking about, right? And that's why we support fuel diversification. I mean, that's why the energy portfolio should be diversified.
I think that's one of the key questions in terms of the time horizon on the renewable energy portfolio standard is that as we're moving forward, which capital investments are we going to make as a state? And as we have to look at them economically, we have to look at them kind of in terms of predictability and reliability. But we also know that we are going to be making a transition. And so if we're going to make, an investment that ratepayers across the state are going to pay one way or another, are we going to, accelerate that transition to renewables while still doing our best to maintain reliability, or does it remain more economic and worth, the higher carbon footprint of developing natural gas moving forward? And as I'm comparing the two versions of the bill, just getting myself oriented here today, is a pretty dramatic change in the renewable energy standards in each version of the bill. And I think I want to understand kind of, you know, what the horizon is in terms of natural, you know, reliable and affordable natural gas for folks that are on the rail belt moving forward. And what would the additional capital cost to be both on, you know, the renewable side and on the natural gas side so that we could be making, you know, a calculated decision as policymakers for the people of Alaska.
Let's try to wrap up this invited testimony so we can finish the invited testimony, if we could, just in respect for everyone's time.
Sure. The amendment or change to the CS that was put in the most recent version related to a levelized wheeling rate for renewable energy. We believe there should be a change in that because it creates a conflict between 4205 431C, which is the Bradley Lake exemption, and Bradley Lake would be considered a renewable energy agreement or a renewable energy or a clean energy resource under this bill. The agreements for the Bradley Lake project are not regulated by the RCA. They were exempted under 431C1. The challenge is that there's a very complex set of agreements that were agreed to that govern the wheeling and delivery of Bradley Lake energy. And those were negotiated back in the 80s. And if the current bill passed, you would have a conflict between the Bradley Lake exemption and the current bill, which would lead us into somehow we would have to figure that out. So we think that should probably be amended to perhaps reflect projects that are built on a going forward basis and leave some of those projects that have existing wheeling arrangements, which are very intricate and tied together and were quid pro quo things. So it's very, very difficult to unwind. In fact, that particular statute was upheld after a number of years of litigation by the state Supreme Court in 2019. And so there's that.
I think that the final thing that we just leave you with is looking at the right now, there's a very prescriptive list of what things are acceptable and what aren't. It's hard for us to sit here in 2022 and know what that list should be, considering we're looking, you know, at something decades in the future. And so we would support some sort of review every 2 to 3 years by some sort of independent source, whether that's the Alaska Energy Authority, whether that's the RCA, whether that's the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. This was also something that was supported by the REIT board through during their conversations was let's take a look at these technologies and make sure that we're not limiting because there's a lot on the horizon and we want to be able to take advantage of everything we can. So we would hope that was another topic that was discussed in House Energy and decided let's have more conversation about that. So just wanted to put that to the top of this group's list. And again, thank you for your time and the ability to provide testimony.
Thank you.
We are available and around for questions at any time.
Thanks. Thanks for being
thank
here.
Thank you so much.
Next up in invited testimony is Alan Mitchell, and Mr. Mitchell is here to provide some economic analysis. And part of the concept here was to have some continuity of testimony with the Energy Committee, but also add some new input. So thanks for being here, Mr. Mitchell.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm getting a little echo. I'm going to turn my volume down here.
If you just keep going,
thank you very much for inviting me today to testify. A little bit about my background. I've been working on technical and economic analysis of both energy and telecom projects for a bit over 30 years here in Alaska. I actually grew up in Palmer, and I currently reside in Anchorage. And actually, the work I did here was not for REAP. It was my own work. I haven't received payment for this work from anyone. So what I did do was a very preliminary economic analysis, and I totally agree with Ms. Esty that it would be great to find the funding to get NREL to do a more serious economic analysis. But I did want to look at least at one of the scenarios that was put forth by NREL in their study. Again, they mapped out 5 different routes for achieving the 80% renewable standard here in the rail belt, and I picked out scenario 3, which predominantly relies upon wind and solar as the renewable means to get to that 80%. And I went a step further than their analysis. I changed nothing in the work that they did, but I took the results where they indicated how much capacity of wind we would need to achieve. achieve the 80%, how much capacity of solar. And I assigned some preliminary benefit and cost numbers to that scenario. There's a link on the slide there to some more details about what I did if people want to dive in a little more. But could you move to the next slide, which is slide 2. So this is the graph that Chris showed in his presentation. It's basically a summary of the benefits and the costs that I came up with. The red bar on the left is my estimate of the capital costs of implementing this scenario, and I came to the number $3.2 billion, which I'll explain a little bit more on the next slide. And then the green bar on the right is the estimate of present value benefits over the life of these investments, which I estimated to be 22 years. So if you add up the fuel savings with proper discounting over that life, you come to this $6.7 billion number. The fuel savings were actually done by NREL. I didn't modify those in any way. I did reduce those fuel savings somewhat by the added operating and maintenance costs of the renewable facilities required. So what this shows is benefits far exceed the costs. In fact, if you were to double the capital cost, you still would see some net benefit. Next slide, which is slide 3. So this is a table that drills deeper into the $3.2 billion capital cost estimate. If you look at the rightmost column in this table, you see it adds up to $3.24 billion. But it breaks it down by renewable generation source. The little bar chart to the right gives you an idea of the relative magnitude of the different components there. You can see this is the wind solar scenario, and the capital costs are very much dominated by wind and solar. You will note there are no transmission and battery storage costs in this table, because NREL actually assume that both transmission and battery storage would be built in the status quo case, the non-renewable case, and in all of the renewable cases. So it was common. It was a common investment to everything. So it's not a net investment associated with renewables. So the two big cost elements here are wind and solar, and I'll tell you a little more how I came to those numbers. So the wind number, you see that the scenario says that we need to add 802 megawatts of wind. What NREL didn't tell us, well, how much will that cost? So what I did was I looked at the Eva Creek wind farm that Golden Valley Electric brought online in 2012. If you look at what it cost Golden Valley to build that in 2012, it came in at about 1.94, a bit less than twice the cost per kilowatt of the national average wind farm. So I took the 1.94 multiplier and I applied it to current day national average wind costs. So my estimate here is roughly twice the capital cost per kilowatt for wind of what it costs in the lower 48 right now. For solar, I did something similar, used a 1.46 multiplier. That multiplier is consistent with the publicly stated estimates of the proposed Homer Electric 20-megawatt solar farm, that renewable IPP that Ms. Esty mentioned is proposing to Homer. So that's where the 1.46 came from. And again, these components totaled $3.2 billion. Next slide, please. This is the last slide. So I think there were a number of things that made this analysis on the conservative side, and here are a couple of them. So as Chris pointed out, solar and wind has declined dramatically in cost, and these numbers differ very slightly from what he said, but not much. Solar has declined roughly 85% since 2010 when you adjusted for inflation. Wind cost has declined by 65%. So in my analysis, even though most of these renewable investments to implement scenario 3 will occur, 5 to 15 to 20 years from now, I did not assume any further decline in solar and wind costs. I think that there very, very certainly will be, but I didn't factor any sort of projection of further decline in solar and wind cost into my analysis. Secondly, the NREL study, the fuel price estimate, involved an Alaska Energy Authority fuel price forecast that went up through 2040. These renewable projects are going to save fuel well beyond 2040. I did not project fuel prices to increase beyond just the general rate of inflation beyond the year 2040. So no added escalation in fuel price beyond 2040. I didn't take any credit whatsoever, any economic credit for the reduced carbon emissions that these projects will bring about. So I didn't assume, you know, we're avoiding a bunch of carbon tax. I didn't impute any dollar value to the reduced carbon emissions. And finally, I didn't factor in any sort of federal subsidies for the renewable projects. I assume they were entirely funded by Alaskans. So that's all I have, and certainly we'll hang around for questions here.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Mitchell, and thanks for hanging out after our final invited testifier in case committee members have more questions. Final testifier is Aaron McKittrick, a board member with Homer Electric, and we haven't heard from a board member from Utilities yet, so thanks for being here, Ms. McKittrick.
Thank you for having me, and as you mentioned, I am a board member of Homer Electric. I live in Soldovia, and I am not speaking on behalf of Homer Electric today. I'm speaking on behalf of myself. So in addition to being on the board, I have a deep interest in energy and have done a lot of independent analysis of the rail belt system, looking at things like the economics of our current system, carbon emissions, and more. I can't see your screen, so I know I had two graphs, and I have no idea if one of them is on that or not.
We have both.
Okay. So I guess I want to say to start out with, I think having a clean energy standard is a really important thing for Alaskan consumers and will be a really good thing. And I guess those two graphs I put up for a little background is that while our generation system really hasn't changed much in the last decade on the rail belt, the circumstances around it are pretty different. So there's one graph that shows the uses of cook inlet gas over time. And when a whole lot of gas was being produced in cook inlet, the local users were just kind of along for the ride, almost an afterthought. It was mostly being produced for things like agrium, for exports, and so it was this much bigger market. And then there was that steep decline as that, you know, started to get less and less economically viable. And now we're pretty much down to a very small market that's pretty much just NSTAR, the electric utilities, and mostly the oil gas industry itself for the last little chunk. And the other graph I put in was looking at the state tax credits. And so I think when we talk about our current system and the price of gas and what's going to happen in the future, we need to remember that we've already stepped in to avert local energy crisis with substantial state money. You can see those yellow bars represent it was about $1.3 billion, and in several years, those state subsidies were more than all the utilities were paying put together. And as the market is even more fragile, and as was mentioned earlier, there's gas out there, but it might be more costly to get it to people. I think the state may well be on the hook for more rescues like that and that really diversifying our fuel sources, moving towards renewables, if this, we invest in renewable energy projects instead, those are tangible things going forward. When I think nobody really knows how long the relative price stabilization from those subsidies will last. And so that's just a little background that I thought was important to have. I think that a few sort of more specific things that I wanted to talk about. A lot of people have, people have mentioned in previous testimony the importance of utilities working together. And I think that one of the things in building renewable projects is that it's often easier to do this with a better economy of scale. So if you potentially build a project that more than one utility can use, you can maybe get it cheaper, and that can help everybody. And so some things that are necessary for that coordination is often moving power around between the different utilities. And transmission is part of that. And NREL anticipated in their study that transmission upgrades would be necessary to reach that 80% number. And I think that's true. And I think that the utilities are working to find funding for that. But one of the things that NREL didn't do because they didn't have time was to look at those lower, more intermediate targets. I think it's important to remember that there's actually a lot of renewable energy we could build and use and transfer its power on the grid as it is now, as we're working on building those things. Homer Electric has a goal of 50% renewable energy by 2025, and we anticipate that that is possible with before new transmission is built. The constraints on the current transmission system aren't true for every direction. So if a line is full going north, it's not necessarily full going south. So depending on where you put your projects, you can transfer a lot of power on those lines. So I think that it's important not to think that we don't have to wait for those transmission improvements to start down this path. I know that Brian mentioned the Bradley agreements and how those affect transmission wheeling. And I would say that it is important to have a simple unified rate going forward to transfer this renewable energy along our existing power lines. I don't know if it would be necessary to specifically exclude Bradley from that to avoid legal conflicts, but I imagine that could be done. Bradley is specifically excluded from all kinds of things, and I imagine that could be done without destroying the intent of freely moving power from other projects. I do think that there is, in this bill, one kind of specific detail that's sort of important is there's a credit system that lets utilities trade credits for clean power, and it works on the rail belt between those utilities. And House Energy recently modified that to be statewide, and I think the intention behind that was to potentially provide some benefits to rural Alaska, but as it's written, I think it could have some substantial unintended consequences because there's actually a very large amount of renewable energy produced in Alaska by about 9 large hydro projects in Southeast Alaska and Kodiak. And so if any renewable energy in the state could help meet these goals, there would be a big incentive for those utilities in Southeast and Kodiak to start selling those credits cheaply. And it wouldn't really necessarily benefit anyone. Those places have cheaper power than the Rail Belt, and they don't really need to build more renewable power themselves in many cases because they already are pretty much running on hydro. If the credit system was modified to be either on the Rail Belt or PCE eligible utilities, that would solve the problem. Those are small rural utilities with high costs, and their total amount of power generation is much smaller. So they could sell credits in the Rail Belt, but still build projects. So that's just one small specific thing. I also think the costs are an important thing to look at. And one key, thing is that a lot of these are looking at fuel savings, and that's because our current power generation is so expensive that in many cases it might well be possible to build and operate a renewable project for just that fuel cost of running an existing plant. So it doesn't really, you don't have to take those existing plants off the books. You don't need to dismantle them. We actually have a lot of existing gas plants that we hardly ever use on the Rail Belt that are, because they're really inefficient, but you keep them around, they're still there, and you didn't have to wait till they were broken in order to build something new. So I think sometimes people think, well, we've got all this existing generation, but there's already precedent to build newer, better generation and keep the less efficient stuff as a backup. That makes sense even when you're not talking about renewables. It will make sense with renewables too. So I don't think we need to wait for our existing plants to be at the end of their life. And with that, I think I will let you move on, and I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. McKittrick. And if you don't mind emailing your recommendations, I'd appreciate it. Definitely appreciate the input on the renewable energy credits. Do committee members have questions for any of the invited testifiers before we go to a summary of changes from the Energy Committee? Okay, Representative Hardy.
Thanks. So it's already been mentioned that there's certain areas that have more resources, and you mentioned already Kodiak. I'm very familiar with Kodiak. And then there's other areas that don't have that so easy access to alternative renewable type energy. What are your thoughts regarding that aspect there? Because it doesn't appear that one thing fits all.
Chris, or sorry, if you want to go ahead, Ms. McKittrick, go ahead.
I'm not sure who that was directed to, but since I was the one who brought up Kodiak, so the Rail Belt, this standard applies to the Rail Belt, and so it is all tied together. So if there are enough renewable resources on the Rail Belt to meet this. The credit system is a way to, in lieu of meeting some portion of that standard, to buy credits from another utility elsewhere in Alaska. And so presumably those villages or other areas that had access could sell those credits. This bill wouldn't solve the problem of, providing energy to all villages. Like, it's intended to focus on the Rail Belt. So it doesn't attempt to answer that question about what villages with no access to renewable resources should do.
Thank you, Ms. McKittrick. Do other committee members have questions? And Representative McCarty, I'm going to suggest that we follow up offline with a more detailed discussion on renewable energy generating capacity with some of the testifiers, because I think there is, but we can talk about that in greater detail. Okay, if Ryan Johnston could describe changes in the energy CS and amendments that were adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Ryan Johnston, staff representative Calvin Trage. So, running through the summary of changes, starting on page 1, lines 1 through 3, the title was amended to take into account the change from a renewable energy standard to a clean energy standard, and then to also include language about AEA. Later on in the summary of changes, there was a reporting mechanism added to the Alaska Energy Authority. Page 1, lines 9 through 11, after energy resources, as discussed earlier, adds to the purpose section, costs, minimizing costs for consumers, increase stability for economic development, and maximize grid resiliency, and minimize the state's carbon emissions. Page 1, line 14, adds a new section to AS4205381 that directs the Electrical Reliability Organization to develop a uniform transmission services rate for the transmission of energy to comply with the clean energy standard under AS4205900. So just to be clear, any language or any energy transmission done from the generation of clean energy would be covered under that transmission tariff, and anything existing currently either from normal production would not be covered. So page 2, line 15, amends subsection B to be more aligned with utility industry language. Page 3, lines 27 through page 4, lines 3, amends the benchmarks for the clean energy standard to form from 4 to 3, the first being 25% by December 31st, 2030, the second being 55% by December 31st, 2040, and then finally, the third being 80% by December 31st by 2050. The third benchmark was amended in the House Energy Committee to now only apply to the rail belt, while the first two are directed at utilities individually. Page 4, lines 18 through 23, adds a new section to AS4205900 that would allow for construction that has begun prior to the end of a compliance period to be counted to fulfilling the clean energy standard if the project will begin providing energy no later than 2 years after the compliance period or at the end of a period determined by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. This section was added to give more leeway for larger construction projects that potentially would happen, so the RCA would have the ability to determine that time period.
If I could just ask a question on that, Mr. Johnston. So that means if we have a deadline of 25% by 2030 and there's a large project that would get to 25% but it's not actually producing yet by 2030, it's just has been developed or is being developed, then the utilities are meeting the requirements. Is that an accurate layperson understanding of what that means?
Ryan Johnston, that's correct, Mr. Chair. And technically, if it fell within the two-year period, it would be fine. The gray area would be as if it was going to fall after the two-year period, the utilities would then have to make a case to the RCA to determine the period of time in which it could comply.
Thank you.
Page 5, line 2, add the new section to AS4205900, stating that a load-serving entity may satisfy the clean energy standard using clean energy credits. page 5, line 4, adds a new section to AS4205900 that a project located wholly or partially on state lands are exempted from state lease fees. In the House Energy Committee, it had been at 10 years, and then it was amended to be for the life of the asset. Page 5, line 20, adds a new section to empower the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to monitor the effect of the clean energy standard on rates and reliability and determine if that is consistent with the public good. Page 5, line 23 through page 6, line 4, amends the previous credit system to now be the clean energy credits. A clean energy credit may only be used once by a utility. A credit may only be used to, or may be used to comply with the clean energy standard without the purchase or use of the electricity generated. This is really about owning the rights to the renewableness of the generation. The energy from which the credit is derived must be generated from the state of Alaska, within the state of Alaska. So really a credits-based system focused on the whole of Alaska instead of just the rail belt like the previous version.
And if I could ask a question about that, is it, following up on Ms. McKittrick's comments, is it written now that existing hydro from Southeast could be counted, or do we need to add language clarifying that this is only new generation?
For the record, Ryan Johnson, Mr. Chair, the way the bill is currently written, it could be existing or new projects. So yes, and there have been some conversations after the energy hearing about potentially scaling this down, because the intent of the amendment was to really create a link between rural Alaska and the rail belt, since this bill is so heavily focused on the rail belt, and then creating a credit system that would essentially allow a revenue stream for our small rural power producers to participate in a clean energy standard.
Thank you. So that is a change I think we'll need to pursue. And the idea is that the most economic project might be in Bethel or Southeast, and we want to encourage that, but not just count everything that's already there and thereby do nothing. So thank you for that explanation.
Page 7, line 6, after commission, there was a word change from may to shall, and this was in when the fines could be waived, and before it was may, where the RCA may ask for more documentation, and it was changed to shall to ensure that the record is growing as a utility is working towards those benchmarks. Page 7, lines 16 through 20, amends the previous exemptions section to a single exemption. The new exemption states that if the rail belt achieves the clean energy standard, that the individual load-serving entities are exempted. And that's just for A of that subsection, so for the first two benchmarks, because the third benchmark was changed now to be rail belt-focused. Page 7, lines 24 through 28, just adds a definition of clean energy credit. Page 7, line 29, amended the definition of renewable energy resource and renamed it the clean energy resource. And it was also cleaned up by legislative legal from the initial draft, just did not conform with legislative drafting standards. And then there was a addition of nuclear generation in that as well from our House Energy Committee. Page 8, lines 6 through 8, amends the previous definition of renewable energy standard to now be a clean energy standard. And it was also just reordered within the definition section to be more in line with our drafting standards. Page 8, line 11, amends the compliance period to be a 10-year period now. Page 8, line 26, adds a new subsection to AS4483940. This new subsection would require that the Alaska Energy Authority shall provide a report to the legislature every 2 years on the progress developing renewable and clean energy resources in rural parts of the state of Alaska. Page 9, line 3, the regulations language for the RCA of Alaska was cleaned up by legislative legal because they already had the existing authority for drafting of the regulations. So the new Regulatory Commission of Alaska language is just more in line with our drafting standards.
Mm-hmm. Representative Svanos.
Yeah, I have a question going up to the change in the nomenclature for renewable energy resource to clean energy resource. I'm wondering if you could unpack that a little bit. I mean, why we're using clean as opposed to renewable?
For the record, Ryan Johnson, Co-Chair Sponholt. So initially when renewable energy was in the bill, it was that definition you saw. And there was some discussion about, because there is a definition for the bill itself and would be for the title and the statute, that you could add whatever you wanted technically to that renewable energy resource definition, because that would be the section that someone would derive what could and could not be counted towards the clean or renewable portfolio standard at the time. So with the addition of nuclear, it made much more sense to set the precedent with clean rather than renewable, because it is generally not accepted that nuclear is a renewable energy resource, but it is considered a clean energy resource. So that was a part of the change.
Oh, okay, and I was looking at page 7, lines 29 through 31, and not continuing on to the next page where I see on line 5 it adds in nuclear. So that makes sense. Thanks.
Thank you.
And just for the record, Mr. Chair, there was a lot of conversation about the NREL study today, and with our conversations with NREL, we actually got a cost estimate and a time period breakdown from them very recently, so if that was something the committee would be interested in, I can pass that along as well.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
And I did want to mention for members, I think the Energy Committee heard this bill for like 2 months. It was very extensive, and if committee members who weren't on Energy want to see how other states have implemented RPSs or want to see that NREL testimony, we can definitely share that. Chairman Shiragi and I spent a lot of time on the bill. Happy to talk to members if they have questions. I know Representative Kaufman did too and extensively amended it. So let us know if you have other questions. The amendment deadline for this bill is Thursday at 9 a.m. I hope we can amend and pass it on Friday. Do members have other questions for any of the invited testifiers or Ryan Johnson at this time? Okay. Thanks to all the invited testifiers who gave their time and expertise today. Next up is House Bill 382, Insulin Coverage, from Representative Snyder.
No, I think that makes sense. And I would say, that's the language that we used to.
Yeah.
Brian and I had a lot to talk about it on that airplane that last week. I said, so that was something you had. There we go.
Yeah. Thank you for being here, Representative Snyder.
Thank you for having us before the committee, Co-Chair Fields, Co-Chair Spanholtz, and thank you to the committee for the quick consideration of HB 382. It is not nearly as complicated or as involved as the bill we were just hearing about, but it does have the potential to have some pretty immediate and meaningful impacts to Alaskans' pocketbooks, and I'm happy to bring it before you today. HB 382 addresses insulin, specifically the really high costs of insulin. I think it would not be an overstatement to say the insulin prices are astronomically high. If you looked back to 1996, a vial of insulin had a list price of $21. Today, that same bottle of insulin has a list price of around $300. And if you look at the rate of inflation, that's four times what we would expect that vial to cost based on inflation alone. What that does for a lot of folks with diabetes, that puts them in a situation oftentimes where they are making choices about what they can spend their limited household income on when they do need to purchase insulin and other things that compete, like rent or food. And I'll speak a little bit later about some of the negative consequences and costly adverse impacts associated with rationing insulin or not following a typical prescribed schedule of insulin. So just to get an idea of the issue that we're talking about here in Alaska, about 49,000 people in Alaska have diagnosed diabetes. An additional 15,000 people in Alaska have it but don't know it yet. And every year, we see another 5,000 people in Alaska diagnosed with diabetes. This is a growing problem that we are facing in our state and across the nation. About 34% of Alaska's adult population, or about 182,000 people, have prediabetes with blood glucose levels that are higher than normal, but not yet high enough to be diagnosed as diabetes. So we have a good portion of Alaskans at risk of developing diabetes. So we're talking about a bill that has the potential to impact a significant proportion of our state's population. If you look at other places that have passed similar legislation, in my notes, I have 16 states with several more pending with similar legislation. We'd been informed as we were moving this bill forward. I think we're at about 20 states now. Some additional details: in Minnesota, two health insurers, Medica and UCare, they decided independently to cap insulin costs at $25 a month for their patients, and Blue Cross Blue Shield announced a zero copay cap for their patients on insulin. So it's becoming more broadly considered capping this copay as a very important mitigation measure for Americans. Medicare Part D plans have also recently agreed to cap insulin at $35 per month starting in 2021. But these are just steps in the right direction. It does not directly impact Alaska, and we have an opportunity for Alaskans to also feel this same benefit. I know one thing that comes to mind for folks when considering capping copays is what will that do to the cost of insurance? Will that result in an increase of insurance premiums for everyone? And the data don't actually bear that out. If you look at the Milliman study from 2017, they found that the cost to provide the benefit would be about 70 to 95 cents per member per year. And what that doesn't account for is potential to reduce premiums overall, because when you have better managed diabetes through improved access through insulin, you have decreased healthcare costs associated with the complications of poorly managed diabetes. We hear a lot about amputations and ulcers and other pretty significant costly impacts. The state of Washington voted to cap its insulin copays at $100 a month in 2021. There, they noticed an average proposed rate decrease of almost 2% within that year. Kentucky introduced an insulin copay cap. They saw 0.07 to 24 cents or 7 to 24 cents per person per month on fully insured policies. Similarly, we saw something happen along those lines in California. So just to reiterate, this bill, and I should have asked the co-chairs, we could have given an overview of the one change that happened in Hess, and I could, when you're ready, we can
go
highlight
for it.
That. Okay. James, would you like to highlight the one change? This is James from my office.
For the record, my name is James Holzenberg, staff's representative Liz Snyder. There was one change that came over from House Health and Social Services. This was to Section 2, coverage for treatment of diabetes. On page 2, line 6, it brings the proposed copay cap down to $35. Thank you.
And I would just say in closing, this is an opportunity to make a small change to something that affects many Alaskans that can have a long-term beneficial impact for all Alaskans, regardless of whether or not they experience diabetes themselves. Thank you.
Thanks. And for committee members who hadn't followed it, that $35 was consistent with other states' best practices and pending federal legislation, hence the change. Do committee members have questions for Representative Snyder or her staff or Lori Wingheyer? Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. So looking at a Utah plan that they have, and the question that is brought up in actually Hess, was can we get bulk like we do for flu or for different virus type things or such, so the state buys it in bulk, and by buying it in bulk then brings the cost down. What are your thoughts to that piece there? And
do you want me to
discovered?
Call on Ms. Wingheyer, Representative Snyder?
I can provide a brief response, and then if Director Wingheyer would like to hop in. Yes, I think that's a fantastic and very logical and great, Rep. McCarty. And you did make that request for information in the Hess committee, and we did hear from Director Wingheyer that they had not explored that opportunity up until this point. But I think at your request, that is certainly something that maybe we can continue to pursue and see if that works. Director Wingheyer also noted that the program in Utah had been going for a couple years. It was unclear if there were good data quite yet to demonstrate its success. But I share your interest in that approach and would look forward to finding out more if that could be a good option for Alaska.
This is a great opportunity to hear from Lori Wingheyer before we go on to the next question. And maybe, Ms. Wingheyer, you could just briefly summarize other items you looked into at our request related to the price of insulin.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lori Wingheyer, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. And for the Hess Committee, we had been asked several questions, and one was a little bit to talk about the Vaccine Assessment Council, which is actually run through the Department of Health and Social Services. I think they may be on the line. At the current time, the Vaccine Assessment Council is, through the chair, more to Representative McCarty's question, where the state does buy vaccines in bulk, and then the providers access the vaccines
from the state to get the lowest cost possible for vaccines for children, infants, and even vaccines that you and I might need. HES may have further comments on that, but the what their response was is that they could look at the Vaccine Assessment Council, much like they could look at the Utah program, but it is not addressed in that this legislation, and we'd need to take it up in another bill at another date to either mirror what Utah has done or look what we have with our own resources and be able to get the insulin in bulk.
Thanks, Ms. Winghire. Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Follow-up, thank you to the chair. Does HES have the ability to do this if they see that they can buy it in bulk rather than waiting for a statute change?
Through the chair, that would be a question that HES would have to answer. And I don't know if Dr. Cutchins is on the line today or not, but he would probably
They're not right now.
I think, if I may, through the chair to Representative McCarty, I think when HES was in the other committee, they said that they did need the legislation and they would need to do some analysis as to what it would take to bring it into Alaska as a bulk purchase.
And now let's go to a question from Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. In your work on this, did you determine the root cause of the high prices?
We have a little information on that. My key takeaway is that, and I believe we have someone from the Diabetes Association on the line who can speak in even more detail than I can. The short of it is there is not, unlike other prescription drugs, there's not a generic option for insulin. There's different forms and there's different ways of delivering it and there's different manufacturers, but it's different than other types of prescriptions that have cheaper generic options. You don't have that with insulin. So it opens the door to being for pharmaceutical companies to charge ever-increasing prices, which we're seeing happen over the past several decades because individuals need insulin to survive.
Follow
up. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. So if we're not actually affecting the price, then what we're left with is distributing the cost across the system.
I can respond to that comment.
Go ahead, Representative
Thank you,
Snyder.
Chair Fields. Yes, initially, I would say. This is certainly not, this bill is not where I would like to stop with this issue. Initially, we are distributing the cost. We have seen in various studies across multiple states that it is very minimal, and on net, it's a savings to everyone because then we have lower costs associated with hospitalizations and adverse impacts associated with uncontrolled diabetes in the range of thousands of dollars per individual. So there is that issue. There are other solutions that can assist in this. My argument is by passing legislation on a copay, it does also spur the insurance companies to feel a little more motivated to put thin pressure on the pharmaceutical companies to drive those costs down. They don't have that pressure right now, and that's why, in my opinion, and from others who have looked into this as well, we're not seeing that cost pressure come down. There's no motivation. The inertia is pretty hard to get over. We do hear from, and what's been interesting is we introduced this bill, and we might have anticipated a great deal of pushback, and we really haven't received that. We did receive one letter from AHIP, the Association for Health Insurance Providers. And they do identify a range of other things that we can also do. And I agree, such as, and I want to make sure I get the language correctly, improving drug pricing transparency. I think we have a co-chair here that would be supportive of that angle. And banning pay for delay is another one that they recommend, but it's interesting because banning pay for delay, that they would recommend this for diabetes because banning pay for delay has to do with companies paying other pharmaceutical companies to delay the release of generic options. But that doesn't really apply here for diabetes. So there's some challenging recommendations in this single letter that's in the bill packet pushing back on this bill that aren't quite transparent or accurate.
And Representative Kaufman, I I asked a lot of questions about kind of root cause in Hess, and I mean, to be honest with them, the pharmaceutical companies are engaged in price gouging, and I think, and I asked the administration, and I understand they're exploring looking at taking action through the Attorney General's office, because the price increases are so far in excess of anything that they could possibly attribute to production costs that I think it is clear abuse of the system, and I hope we see investigation and follow-up on that from the AG. Representative Coffman.
Yes, follow-up on that. I guess what I'm wondering, if we put a cap on it and then they spread the cost across all of the other insurance subscribers, let's call it, and I don't really see where there's downward pressure, because the insurance company, they're flexible. They can share those costs. It doesn't really transmit it back to the insulin manufacturer, the drug company. So I'm just wondering if there's any mechanism that we could put in here that would tighten that up a little bit and not just make it a cost-sharing bill and would actually make it a downward pressure bill. Thank you.
Representative Snyder.
I would look forward to exploring such an amendment with you either here or ahead of the floor.
Mm-hmm. Representative Spahnholz.
Yeah, and I think, I appreciate the sentiments in Representative Kaufman's questions. In hearing the bill in the Health and Social Services Committee, we actually learned, and I think maybe I'll ask Representative Snyder to reiterate as well, that that this is one of those cases, making sure that people are getting their insulin and not rationing this life-saving medication, this life-saving treatment, actually results in cost savings many of the time. And if I remember correctly, there was a 2017 Milliman study that actually identified that there was a savings every year and associated with this policy of 70 to 95 cents per member per year, which seems pretty modest. But when you think about it over the long term and the productivity that's associated with not having amputations, not undergoing blindness, not having ulcers and all the other things that, you know, contribute to lost work productivity, you could actually see that not only is there not just this 70 to 95 cents per year per member savings, but there's actually a net increase in productivity of, Americans who receive access to this care. And could you confirm that number for us?
Yes, you're in the ballpark, Rep. Spahnholz, and I'd be happy to provide some additional details, some details that I have here that, and it's also in the sponsor statement, that might be where you're remembering seeing it. We do have data showing us that irregular insulin use can increase inpatient hospital costs by up to 41%. That's huge. Mm-hmm. One of the more common things, or one of the issues that many folks are familiar with, associated with poorly managed diabetes is foot ulcers, for example. We see folks charged up to $16,000, $17,000 for foot ulcer treatments, which if you don't treat those can then lead to amputation, which is, I can tell you from family experience, not from diabetes, but dealing with amputation is a horrendous and a horrendously expensive experience. We'll be dealing with that for quite some time. And if you think about other issues, complications from end-stage renal disease, for example, we're in the hundreds, $120 billion price tag with complications associated with that. So, yes, I think there's definitely additional opportunity to deal with the high prices coming out of the pharmaceutical industry itself. But a copay cap can have an initial, first, and very quick reduction in some of these expenses, both to the individual with diabetes and those sharing a plan. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. At this time, let's go to public and invite testimony. So opening public testimony, I don't see anyone in the room who wants to provide testimony. Online, we have Laura Keller with the American Diabetes Association. Ms. Keller, please proceed with your testimony.
Great. Committee, this is Laura Keller and chair with the American Diabetes Association. I want to thank you for hearing this bill. And you're right. There are a lot of different levers that can be pulled to address the cost of medications like insulin throughout the chain. But as a person with type 1 diabetes, there is no other option. And people are rationing and they are dying because they do not have access to this life-saving medication. And so, as you've heard, there's many reasons why we are urging the committee to take action now. This helps people with insurance. The Utah scenario that you're talking about, that you're exploring, which is a great secondary thing to do, would impact people who also don't have health insurance. But this is a great first step, and it's making a difference in people's lives. And a study came out in California, a nonpartisan study, that showed that with an insulin copay cap, a state can reduce their diabetes-related hospitalizations by 10% in the first couple years after the bill passes. So there will be other savings to the state. People with diabetes need the insulin. There's no other option. And just so you know, to make insulin, the insulin analogs that we're talking about that are in our insulin pumps and that people primarily with type 1 diabetes use as an industry standard, that ranges from $3 a vial to a little under $7 a vial. And that includes a company being able to make back their R&D and their marketing and everything. And so this is definitely one of those situations that is different than a lot of other medications. And so I just want to say thank you for your time, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Keller. I don't see anyone else online. I'm going to close public testimony, Ms. Keller, but then you can stay online to answer questions. So I'm going to close public testimony. Thank you for remaining online to answer questions. Ms. Keller, Representative McCarty has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Keller. Through the chair, I have lots of questions. One is the aspect of generic. So my understanding is that after medication has been around for a while, so many years, I believe it's seven, that it goes generic. Insulin's been around for a long time. Is there generic insulin?
Committee, this is Laura Keller with the American Diabetes Association, and there is not generic insulin on the market currently. There are the companies who make insulin have rebranded some of their insulin to be considered a generic. It's the exact same product. It's the exact same manufacturer. Unfortunately, those generic medications are priced very similarly and therefore still not a copay of $25 for people.
Okay.
Go ahead, Representative McCarty.
So is the FDA putting the monopoly kind of thing for these companies in the United States? And with that, can you find insulin at a far lesser rate outside of the United States?
So the FDA is looking at some biosimilars and other options of potentially generic insulins. Nothing's been approved to the market yet. The insulins that we're talking about can be purchased in other countries like Canada, like Mexico. They're the exact same brand. They're the exact same formulation for a much reduced cost. But currently, we're not able to, you know, have health insurance provide those insulins in that way because the FDA has not approved and the federal government has not approved that through proper channel.
Last follow-up. I know that the state of Utah is sending their employees to Mexico to get their medication.
I believe that is correct. I'm not familiar with how they do that or what the costs they're paying for that. But I can tell you I was part of supporting and worked with the representative for the Insulin Utah Purchasing Program, and they allow people to purchase for the same price as the employee price in the state of Utah, and that program has been very successful, and it was a completely online program, and I'm happy to connect anyone to that representative, Thurston, who passed it in Utah, if anybody's ever interested in learning more.
Thank you, Ms. Keller. And we, in the previous committee, as you know, did submit quite a few questions to Ms. Winghire, and I'm particularly interested in finding out how we can obtain insulin directly from Canada and bypass pharma to get lower prices. So hopefully the department will continue examining that. Do committee members have further questions before we take action on this bill? We did not receive any amendments. Okay. Seeing none, is there a motion to move House Bill 382?
Chair, I move House Bill 382, version 32-LS1494/B from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Not seeing any, House Bill 382 passes from committee. Please sign the paperwork as it circulates. And our final, well, actually, we have two more items on the agenda. First, Senate Bill 190, and then we need to make the statement about forwarding confirmation. So thanks to Senator Myers and the staff for being here for our, I think, second hearing on Senate Bill 190.
Good afternoon, Chair Fields, members of the committee. Robert Myers, Senator for District B.
Thanks, Senator Myers. Do committee members have additional questions for Senator Myers before we take action on this bill? Okay. There is one amendment on this bill. It's my amendment, so I'll go ahead and move it at this time, and then we can discuss it. I move Amendment 1.
And I'll object for the purpose of an explanation.
Thank you. At a previous hearing, we discussed Senator Myers, including refuse utilities in the RCA, and I think a consolidated review process, if that's the right terminology. I thought that made a lot of sense, and given that the underlying bill is looking at refuse utilities, I thought it also might make sense to add some consumer safeguards in the event that, say, a municipality decides to change governance of a refuse utility. These were changes suggested by the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. So the amendment before you does not prohibit or require, it doesn't discourage or encourage privatization, but it does say that if a municipality is going to privatize a refuse utility, that there needs to be a review with the RCA to make sure that the proposed privatization is not going to raise costs for consumers beyond those which would be incurred under the existing governance structure. So I'm happy to answer questions from committee members if they have them about this amendment. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. To the chair, concern I have with this is that it would seem to preempt if a utility has been part of a municipality, it may not represent all the costs. There may not be good cost allocation to the operations, maintenance, et cetera. And then to have the clause, let me find it. It will not result in higher rates for consumers. Well, what if the rates that were being charged were not realistic for whatever reason? And so it just seems like it's putting a lid on it that dang near makes it impossible to find out what the market value of the services are. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Kaufman. And yes, it's not my intent to arbitrarily cap rates at a point in time. And my assumption was that the RCA, in doing this analysis, could analyze what are the actual costs incurred by a municipality, what are those costs going to be over a reasonable time horizon, what are the costs going to be under a proposed privatization. So since we have some RCA representatives online, I might go to Mr. Pickett. And Mr. Pickett, if you could just address, if the RCA were analyzing a proposed privatization, would you anticipate that the commission would have the ability to look at what price escalation would be under an existing municipal structure versus potential price escalation under a proposed privatized structure?
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. The first time I saw this amendment was this morning, roughly at 9 o'clock, and it raised some legal questions concerning the rest of our statutes, and I immediately contacted our Senior Assistant Attorney General, Stuart Gehring, to give it a read. And I believe, Mr. Gehring, are you on the line?
Mr. Gehring is online. Mr. Pickett, first, though, can you address, would you anticipate being able to analyze the cost factors sort of under two different scenarios to, you know, make an informed decision on what might be good?
It would be very difficult for a non-regulated municipal utility to do that because there's a wide variation in how they handle their accounting practices. And if they're actually subsidizing the refuse service, you get into intergovernmental cost charges and different entities handle it differently. And so I'm not saying it's impossible. It's just when you don't regulate an entity and you're trying to project a regulatory framework onto it in this analysis and determination of whether it's going to ultimately be in the benefit of the ratepayers, there will be some challenges to it. That's what I'll say.
I guess a follow-up, Mr. Pickett, what would prevent you from asking a municipality what are the costs of providing a refuse collection service, and what do you anticipate those costs will be in the amendment says over a 10-year period?
If you have been through rate cases and the schedules that are required to make those kind of assessments, and again, it gets into the nature of the municipality and how they handle their accounting practices, and then there's some legal issues involved with that too.
Okay. Well, the I don't think the Department of Law has articulated what those legal concerns are, so I'll give the attorney a chance to articulate what they are. Mr. Gearing.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. I think that Chairman Pickett is, I think, referring to, and there's a number of different issues here from a regulatory perspective, and I think a little bit of background on municipal utilities is important, one of which is that, to my knowledge, there are no economically regulated municipal refuse utilities. All of them in the state right now that have certificates are exempt under either AS4205711B, which is the exception for political subdivisions of the state, or in the case of the municipality of Anchorage Solid Waste Services, 4205711D, which means that the RCA does not specify any of the economic conditions of their operations, which includes they don't tell the municipality how to do accounting. There's no uniform system of accounts. There's no uniform depreciation schedules. There's no cost allocation manual for the other governmental operations to share costs with the utility. And as a result, the commission has no previous knowledge of the economics of any of the municipal waste or refuse collection utilities out there. And that makes it, that I think provides a little bit of background for Chairman Pickett's response that it would be extremely difficult, because without that information, the commission would be doing that from scratch. Even with a regulated utility that has been keeping its books and records in the proper form for an economically regulated utility, and with a long history of economic regulation, rate cases often take multiple years. The timeline for those is 540 days, and those sometimes can even go longer with extensions that the parties ask for because of the complications of the cases. So it's not a simple matter to step into the middle of something which has been operating for potentially for, well, since statehood in some cases, and try to figure out the economics of the operation without any background at all. So I think that's where some of the difficulty is coming in for the RCA. As far as legal issues, I'm happy to answer some of those questions, but for the time being, I wanted to make sure that you got the sort of background for the question that you'd ask Chairman Pickett.
Mr. Gearing, I understand.
If I need to go into legal issues, I could do that.
Yeah, I understand that the RCA would be requesting new information. The bill brings in some new responsibilities, and that's why the amendment was introduced. I think Representative Shirocki has a question.
Well, yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Fields. That's what I was going to get to is, I mean, this bill adds refuse utilities under the RCA regulations without this amendment passing, I guess. Are there legal concerns with bringing in refuse utilities under the RCA and or, I assume, some fairly large hurdles in being able to draft and create regulations related to refuse utilities given the lack of experience regulating such utilities? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Shirocki, actually the bill does not bring refuse in as a regulated utility for the first time. Refuse has been a regulated utility class for a long time. What the amendment does that's different from the rest of the bill is that it addresses the municipal refuse utilities. The rest of the bill is there are economically regulated refuse utilities out there. They are privately owned. They do have to follow the commission's regulations on uniform system of accounts. They do have to file periodic rate cases. And the other part of the bill that you're referring to, modifying AMP 4205-381, only changes the way that those rates are made, not assigns responsibility for making those rates in the first place. So actually that part of the bill would simplify the process rather than making it more complicated, but it would not remove any of the background information that the RCA currently gets in the form of annual reports, which municipals don't file, and periodic rate cases, which municipals don't file. So they're really two separate issues. The commission is already regulating refuse utilities. They're just not regulating municipal refuse utilities. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Shragi. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, to Senator Myers, I'm always a little hesitant to add policy, if at all, to a simple extending the termination date of a regulatory commission. Have you taken a stance on this amendment? Has the sponsor of the amendment approached you about this? What's your kind of thoughts on this?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson. So we got this amendment, I believe, Friday. We were still trying to figure out what all it entailed, and so we weren't sure one way or the other. We were going to primarily defer to the RCA and their expertise on this one.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Do members have further questions or discussion on the amendment? I appreciate the RCA's and law's perspective, but honestly, I also appreciate Senator Myers trying to address refuse utilities. I think we have a very capable RCA that's entirely able to analyze complex information, and frankly, information from a refuse utility is a lot less complex than some of the electric utilities they deal with. So, Representative Kaufman, do you maintain your objection?
Actually, it was my objection,
and oh, sorry.
I'm going to remove my objection because I think that, you know, while it would require some work on the part of the RCA in order to clearly, you know, define sort of cost centers and how to accurately measure this, one of the RCA's jobs is to make sure that we aren't unnecessarily increasing ratepayers, you know, rates for individual Alaskans paying utility bills. And they are, as you said, you know, very capable of incredibly complex regulatory oversight and analysis. And they have remarkable staff that I fully trust to be able to do this work. And for that reason, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection.
I object.
Okay.
For purposes of objection.
Thanks, Representative Kaufman. Good job cutting to the chase at 5:08 p.m. Will the secretary call the roll? Is there a secretary who can call the roll? I guess Grace can call the roll if there's no one else available.
I object.
Representative Scott?
I'm going to be a no.
Representative McCarty?
No.
Co-chair Field?
Yes.
Co-chair Sponholt?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
And Representative Snyder?
Yes.
4 days and 3 days?
4 days.
Otherwise.
Four days.
Okay, with that, amendment number one does not pass. I think the next item, thank you, Senator Myers and your staff for being here. The next item on our calendar today is confirmations. We have to go through this before we advance the confirmations. The House Labor and Commerce Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees and recommends the following names be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Julie Sandy, Commissioner, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Doug Moore and Janice Hill, Alcohol Beverage Control Board, Sterling Strait and Brent Cole, Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors, State Board of Registration, Walter Campbell, Board of Chiropractic Examiners, Kathleen Rice, Board of Examiners and Optometry, Dominic Wenzel, Board of Dental Examiners, Kelly Hsu and Amanda Nosich, Board of Massage Therapists, Paula Harrison, Alaska Labor Relations Agency, Bruce Schulte, Eliza Muse and Eli Cyrus, Marijuana Control Board, Tristianne Monterostelli, Board of Marital and Family Therapy, Hannah St. George, Board of Certified Directed-Degree Midwives, Lena Lafferty and Jody Miller, Board of Nursing, Ashley Shaber and Ramsey Bell, Board of Pharmacy, Elizabeth Stewart, Alaska State Board of Public Accountancy, Valerie Kudrin, Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers, Devin Thomas and Chad Steakin, Real Estate Commission, Gabrielle King and Sharon Woodward, Social Board of Social Work Examiners, Ciara Valaro, Board of Veterinary Examiners, Brad Austin, Christopher Dean, Randy Belts, Matt Martin, Michael Dennis, Sarah Faulkner, and Sarah LaFave, Alaska Workers' Compensation Board, Stephen Hagedorn, Workers' Compensation Appeal Commission, signing the report, recommending regarding appointments to boards and commissions in no way reflects an individual member's approval or disapproval of the appointee, and the nomination is merely forwarded to the full legislature for confirmation or rejected. Back on the record, thanks again to our Secretary Leah Frazier and Moderator Emma Turner at 512 House Labor and Commerce is adjourned.